Hello and welcome to the Monocle Winter Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Henry Rees-Sheridan.
It's Christmas Eve, at least on recording date, and we hope all you future podcast listeners got everything you wanted. But today, we're seeing in the big day with a bumper show of Christmas goodies.
The historian and author Judith Flanders will be here to tell us some of the season's lesser-known tales. Stay tuned for Christmas A Biography.
We'll also be talking to wildlife writer Richard Smith about why the humble Christmas robin might not be quite the bird you thought. He'll be discussing this and his book A Sweet Wild Note a little later.
Plus, Monocle's Guy Delaunay will be reporting on ice climbers in Slovenia and looking at why fans of the sport now wanted to be part of the Winter Olympics.
And that's not all. We'll also be speaking to writer, editor and co-founder of the Iceland Writers Retreat, Eliza Reid, about a literary tradition enjoyed in the country each Christmas Eve. And she's well placed to discuss it, being none other than Iceland's First Lady.
The sleigh, Henry, is loaded, the stockings are hung, and sherry, your choice, is at the ready. Let's crack on with the Monocle Winter Weekly Christmas Eve special, right here on Monocle 24. So here we are, Henry, a dusting of snow, metaphorically, upon us. Jingle bells sounding, furtive sniffing about happening by the reindeer.
What's
Christmas almost upon us.
But someone's sniffing by the reindeer, or the reindeer is sniffing?
They're snuffling around. What's... I don't know what a reindeer does.
Neither do I.
But we've got a bumper show. The tree laden. So, Henry, let's on with the show. And I think we should kick off with a biography of Christmas itself. Now, it might be Christmas Eve, but many of the traditions we enjoy during the festive season aren't so easily explained by that origin story of miraculous events that took place in a bygone age.
Germany, for example, is quite partial to a Weihnachtswanderung. That's a Christmas stroll. Tom, you're looking at me.
I know that because of my excellent German.
And Finns keep an eye out for Christmas gremlins. They wear reindeer moccasins, in case you ever wondered.
The historian and author Judith Flanders has compiled an extensive collection of the stories and tales that make up the modern day Christmas. It's called Christmas A Biography, and she joins us today to talk about it. Welcome to the Monocle Winter Weekly, Judith. Why did you set your sights on this particular time of the year?
I would like to say it was a lifelong passion, and I have done nothing in my life but devote my time to collecting stories about Christmas. But actually, I was sitting with my publisher, and he said to me, "So, how about a book about Christmas?" And I said, not a bad idea. And we talked about it for 20 minutes, and then I said, "Oh, you mean me?" I thought he was just making bright chat. So I went away and I did some reading, and after about 3 hours of reading, I realized everything I knew about Christmas was wrong. So I thought, guy's right. Good topic.
Set the record straight, yeah.
So if everything that you knew about Christmas is wrong, it probably applies double to the rest of the population. I'm interested, what were the main presumptions that were undermined during your study?
Oh, there isn't a single legend, and I use the word legend carefully, that is true. It grew out of Saturnalia, or maybe it was the Feast of Woden. Santa Claus was the Dutch Saint Nicholas, or maybe his coat was devised by Coca-Cola, or Prince Albert brought the tree to England. None of these things are true.
So it must be, all of these myths must be hung, though, on something which has been, deeply rooted in the social fabric of Western societies for a long time. What is that peg on which all of these myths have been hung?
I think the most important thing I realised was that when we say today, oh, Christmas used to be better, you know, now it's all crass commercialism, Christmas was better in the old days, whenever those old days might have been. In fact, people have been saying Christmas was better in the old days for, as far as I know, at least half a millennium. The earliest reference I found to this dates from 1616, when in a play by Ben Jonson, one of the characters basically says, oh, Christmas today is garbage. You should have seen it in the old days. So everybody thinks Christmas was better. That is the core of Christmas. We believe that there was a better world, which allows us to believe that maybe we will return to a better world. if there was a time when everybody loved each other, when communities were all warm and embracing, dee-da-dee-da-dee-da, then we hope we will get to that better world. So we encapsulate that in this nostalgia and this idea that Christmas is this magic time of year when everything good will come true. And yet at the same time, we know this is not the case. Uncle Fred is going to get drunk. Our cousin is going to divorce his wife. We know all of those things will happen. So we tell ourselves it was better before.
You've been studying the Edwards household very closely, alarmingly. So in that sense, Judith, then, does Christmas represent something of a prism through which to look at all of the last, what, 400 or 500 years then, of certainly Western history? Because this idea that, you know, things were better, yet we know we've never been healthier, safer, happier than we are today. But there's always this weird nostalgia. And are there particular culprits? I mean, I always think of some of the literary greats, Charles Dickens, for example, who wrote as well about Christmas and its sort of, I guess, what, late, you know, sort of 19th century mythology as well as anybody. But he's partly to blame, isn't he? Because that's the modern, certain English myths built on the foundations that he wrote.
Well, what Dickens did, which was really interesting, was the previous nostalgia about Christmas had all looked backwards. So it was all rural pastimes and happy peasants dancing the traditional Christmas dances or whatever the hell it was. What Dickens did is he said, no, it's a holiday of modernity as well. Mm. It's a holiday you can celebrate if you're a clerk like Bob Cratchit working in an office. It's a holiday that if you work for a dressmaker and you can just slide into the family Christmas dinner at the last minute because you had transport problems, that's still part of the holiday. And so what he did was he took these older traditions and he said, no, they still work. Yes, the world is changing rapidly. But our emotions are the same, our feelings are the same, and the holiday deep down is the same.
Judith, I've been thinking a little bit, just while you were answering that question, about there being an element of maybe utopianism to the Christmas ideal, the idea that it represents, you know, an ideal that we could return to or aspire to. And it just occurs to me that I think one of the great Christmas traditions is conservative columnists kind of moaning, for want of a better word, about how Christmas has lost its sense of value. And I think in more recent years, more specific claims that attempts to celebrate Christmas or explicitly acknowledge Christmas for some reason considered politically incorrect or being repressed in some way. And this cry has most recently been taken up by the President of the US, Donald Trump, this year. I'm interested, how has Christmas been mobilised politically by different people throughout the ages?
Well, it's quite fascinating because as a historian and as somebody who weighs up the evidence very carefully, basically the claim that there's a war on Christmas is, in academic speak, balls. There's just, it makes no sense. Things that they say are happening, like we have switched out season's greetings or happy holidays for Merry Christmas. Well, if you look at the Christmas cards in the 1880s, and, you know, I have happy hobbies, I look at Christmas cards from 1880s, they say season's greetings and happy holidays. The original claim about the war on Christmas was made by that family-friendly anti-Semite Henry Ford, and it was part of his anti-Semitic drive to say that, you know, the other, in his case, the Jews, were making a war on Christmas. In actual fact, of course, as a historian, I'm happy to point out the only war that has ever been made on Christmas has been by Christians. That the only time Christmas has ever been seriously imperiled was in the 17th century when the Puritan Church banned Christmas, actually legally banned it. No one has ever done that except Christians.
And that was Cromwell in England.
It was Cromwell in England. It was the Puritan Massachusetts government in New England. And, of course, the really fun part is in Scotland. They re-banned it, the Scottish Kirk, being very puritanical, banned it in 1690, and then, oops, forgot to unban it. And it stayed banned in Scotland until 1958.
That is absolutely fascinating, isn't it?
It's one. I mean, those are the sorts of beautiful revelations that we can find in your book. I wonder, you talk about this sort of illusory elements in this mythology. Are there any myths, legends, that are kind of better than the truth, that maybe we're better off labouring under the misapprehension of because they're simply a bit more fun or it's a better tale? I mean, are there some things that are best left as a sort of fallacy or whatever you want
well,
to call it?
Well, I like to see the continuity. And one of the things that I really adored is I discovered two things, actually. One was that in the German-speaking lands in the 18th and 19th century, they had sort of bad sidekicks to St. Nicholas, who did the punishing part. And they usually had names that implied they were either servants or outsiders, often with the prefix Ru, R-U, which meant rough. And there was one called RuPaul.
Fantastic.
I really liked that. The other thing I liked was in the U.S. on the Lewis and Clark expedition in 1805 to map out the west of the USA. Either Lewis gave Clark or Clark gave Lewis, I can't remember, what he called fleece hosiery and drawers. He got underwear for Christmas. And I was really happy to see the abiding tradition of boring Christmas presents.
Exactly. Certain things remain self-evident. What was his roughhousing? What did it involve? Best not to ask?
Usually the sidekicks, the saint figure brought fruit and nuts to the good children. And the bad character either carried a whip or a crop, or he brought coal for the bad children. In Zurich, actually, although he wasn't a Rue character, he brought horse manure and dead vines. I mean, happy Christmas, everybody.
Exactly. What are you in line for, Henry? Are you getting coal or horse manure or maybe fruit?
Are there my options? Is that the three options I choose from?
Have you been a good boy this year? That's what I'm asking you.
I mean, I think so. I think so, Tom. You maybe are in a better position to say.
The jury might be off, Judith.
We'll find out tomorrow.
Judith, when we look at the aspects of Christmas celebrations that we continue to observe today, I'm thinking crackers, more obscure ones like, you know, kissing people under the mistletoe. I'm not sure where that would have originated. Where do they come from? And is there a particular period that they all date back to, or have they just been kind of assembled piecemeal over history?
They're very much piecemeal, and some we know about and some we don't. Christmas crackers were actually just an invention of a confectioner, a sweet manufacturer in Clerkenwell, who wanted to make his sweets a little different from everyone else's. So he wrapped them in paper that had a little bit of saltpeter, gunpowder, on them, and when you unwrap them, they went bang. And he marketed
wouldn't get past the Brussels bureaucrats these days.
Well, he marketed them under the very unfortunate slogan "Bangs of Expectation." but they did take off, and gradually the sweet was replaced by a toy, and that's Christmas crackers. So we know all about that. Mistletoe is really interesting because winter greenery has been a thing since the Middle Ages and even before. Mm. Any green branches that were green in the winter, so not merely fir, not merely holly and ivy, bay, rosemary, anything. But mistletoe was one of them. The kissing under it only emerged in the 19th century, and we have no idea why.
Listen, now, we joked at the beginning about you must be sick to the back teeth of Christmas. Nevertheless, it's not stopped us raining questions down on you. There must be things that, in all seriousness, you do particularly look forward to. Is it about those nice ideals, you know, spending time with family, you know, big old feed, big cookout on Christmas Day? I mean, are there things that you do genuinely look forward to? or are you actually sick to
I'm afraid that this goes back to the, oh, you're talking about me story. I'm Jewish. I don't celebrate Christmas.
Okay. But at the time of the holiday season, do you try and avoid the family? I don't know. I don't want to pry, Judith, of course.
You've discovered my secret. I think that the holiday element, the family element, the friends element that leads up to Christmas is great. And then I go inside and I close the front door and thank you very much. It's all over.
Double lock.
Yep.
Lights off.
Yep.
You'll be back in January.
Yep.
Judith, I wonder also if you found out anything interesting about the way in which people from demographics that don't traditionally celebrate Christmas have adapted to the widespread adoption of Christmas as a holiday and a public celebration in countries around the world.
Well, it's very interesting how Christmas is taken over because, you know, I say things like I'm Jewish, which to me means I don't celebrate Christmas. And people say, yeah, so? Because Christmas has become a non-Christian, non-denominational, non-country-based thing. For example, if you Google, and I have spent many happy hours doing this, Christmas trees in Japan, you will find delightful Godzilla-shaped Christmas trees.
What's not to enjoy?
Well, I mean, you know, I would go for a Godzilla Christmas tree. That makes sense to me. They have amazing Christmas trees in Japan, which have partly, I understand, taken on elements of tree decoration from other local holidays that are round about the same season. And yet, at the same time, they have taken on hugely the Christmas element. So this is the reason, I think, that Christmas has been so successful and has thrived so strongly, is that it does both lend itself to other traditions and then reincorporates those traditions and feeds back so that we can enjoy what we call our Christmas. We say, so it's a very English Christmas, but we have the Christmas tree, which we know, I mean, it wasn't Prince Albert, but does come from Germany. We have Santa Claus, who comes from the USA. We can enjoy all these traditions, and yet somehow magically it's still ours.
Well, I just want to ask you very briefly before we wrap up, Judith, is the final, I mean, it's Christmas A Biography is the title of your book. If there was a sort of a further, I don't know, appendix or addendum added, can it ever be a truly secular holiday or a secular time of the year?
I think it's always been secular. I think that's the thing that's fascinating. The first Christmas was named by the Bishop of Rome in the 4th century within 30 years of that date. We know that one of the archbishops was warning his congregation about excessive feasting and dancing on the day.
So something's never changed, right?
It's always been a secular day.
Well, Judith, thank you so much for joining us here in the studio. Christmas, A Biography. Your new book is available in all good bookstores. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Up next, Richard Smith.
Now, one bird, in the United Kingdom at least, is synonymous with Christmas, the humble robin, which adorns Christmas cards each year all over the world. The UK is so attached to the reassuring image that not long ago it picked it as our national bird.
But writer Richard Smith thinks there's other birds we should be hearing more about, so much so that he's written a book about exactly which sounds we should be paying attention to. A Sweet Wild Note looks at how birds use their songs to communicate, and much more. And Richard now joins us on the line from Bradford. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Richard. Firstly, tell us about why you think the robin deserves a more checkered reputation than it has.
Well, I think people are starting to realise, as they become maybe more realistic about the birds we see around us, that the robin is quite outrageous in its in the extent of its territorial fury with regard to other robins, but also with regard to other birds. It's a violently territorial bird that fiercely attacks any other robin that ventures onto its territory. And while, of course, this is just a question of nature red in tooth and claw, and that all birds, to some extent, have a territorial instinct, my case is really that I don't think territorial murder is very Christmassy.
Indeed. And there's some quite arresting figures, aren't there, in your book as well, Richard. I gather that the sheer proportion of robin-on-robin violence is quite arresting.
It's shocking. It's shocking. And Philip Horace pointed this out, the nature writer who wrote a piece when the robin was elected, or re-elected, a national bird. 10% of all adult robin deaths are down to robin-on-robin violence. Again, this is perfectly natural. You can't blame the robin for being a bloodstained thug. But I just suggest it doesn't have a place at the forefront of our Christmas celebrations.
So, Richard, tell us about some other birds who you think we should be paying more attention to.
It depends what you want from a Christmas bird. One reason that the robin has been a popular selection is that it's colourful. A red breast gives you a splash of colour in winter. An alternative on that score would be the redwing, which is a beautiful, small thrush that, for one thing, only visits us in winter, which makes it quite Christmassy. And it's got a lovely sort of vermilion, I would say armpit, but that doesn't sound very Christmassy either. Its flank is a lovely red colour, which brings a dash of vibrancy to the winter landscape. And then there's birds like the woodcock would be a great choice if you wanted something that wasn't a boring old songbird. It's a kind of plump, quiet, country squire of a bird that lives in woodlands and is synonymous in many parts of the country with the winter. But my choice would be the wren. It's one of my favourite birds. Like the robin, it sings all year round. Not all birds do, not many birds do, in fact. But the wren is one song that you can hear all the year round, and it's no less powerful and joyous in the winter than it is in the summer. The wren is also recognisable. It's got this wonderful little cocked tail that singles it out. It's tiny. And one of the lovely things about wrens is that they all huddle together for warmth in the winter. There's records of up to 60 of them huddled together in a single nest box, which I think is a lovely festive image. And while they can be a bit testy and a bit gobby, they're not quite as murderous as robins. And that alone, I think, qualifies them for a place on our Christmas cards.
It does indeed. Tell me, Richard, about this idea of the, I guess what you'd call it, misperceptions or lack of information about different birds and the way that people relate or fail to relate to the bird life around them. Certainly in this country, one imagines that as we become more urbanised, city spread happens more and more, this is going to be ever more of a problem, simply that people don't know. I'm often amazed if I sort of point out to someone something interesting, like that signature flash of colour, and you say, oh, you know, that's a goldcrest or whatever. And people look at you like you've told them that you've seen an alien. Do you sometimes despair at the sort of ornithological ignorance that seems to be spreading ever wider in this country?
To some extent. It's not so much the ignorance as the failure to listen and to look. Mm. I mean, it's all very well not knowing what a bird is called. I mean, that's something you have to go out of your way to learn, and that's, there's nothing wrong, well, not ideal if you don't know these things, but no one's to be blamed for it. But I think not listening, not looking, not paying attention, that's the problem. And I think there's a danger of losing things without knowing what we've lost. I think things might vanish and we won't even realise because we weren't listening. I think there's also something I talk about in my book quite a lot, is we have images of many species of birds that have built up over the centuries through poetry, through culture, through folklore. These are sort of real birds in a sense. They exist very firmly in our cultural consciousness, but they're separate from the actual birds that are around us. One of my favourite little sort of stories that I found when I was researching the book was this quite touching story that this young man had written about a terrible time he was having in London when he was young and he had no money. He was a musician. He writes about in the winter going out and wandering around inner London, and he says that the one thing that raised his heart and lifted his spirits was that he could hear nightingales singing through the night, and what it said, whatever mood you're in, that song will always raise your spirits. Which is a lovely story, but the problem is, there are no nightingales in London, in central London. There are no nightingales anywhere north of Egypt in winter. He simply did not hear nightingales. What he was hearing was almost definitely robins, which sing through the night and through the year. So there's that interesting idea that we have these kind of cultural notions of what a bird is, which can be great, of great comfort to us, but they're quite severely divorced from the reality, which is the case again with the robin, which we see as this friendly little chap who is in fact a brutal bully.
Well, Richard, we've been talking about birds and birdsong enough. I think we'd be remiss not to actually hear some. We're going to play some birdsong now. Perhaps you could have a crack at identifying each song in turn, maybe telling us a little bit about it.
Okay.
Okay, let's try with the first sample of birdsong. Did you get that, Richard?
Yes, I did. Happily.
Okay.
Happily for my reputation, I can recognise that.
Good.
That was a chaffinch. And a chaffinch song is one of the most interesting bird songs for me. For two reasons, really. One is that that chaffinch we just listened to, a trained ear, which I should say I don't really have. I'm an enthusiastic amateur when it comes to recognising birdsong. But a trained ear might be able to pick out where that chaffinch grew up, because chaffinches have dialects, which is quite remarkable. They're so complex, it's not easy to pick out one from another or say specifically where. But in the old days, the bird catchers, who ironically, despite their cruelty to birds, knew them better than most people, were able to pick out which side of the Medway, for instance, a chaffinch came from. The other thing that I love about the chaffinch song is that you can recognise it, and maybe if you play this clip back afterwards, you can listen for this. The best way I've heard of recognising it is that it sounds like a fast bowler going into bowl. This was first originated by the bird writer William Ward Fowler. And if you listen, you can hear it makes a run up. It's quite a short run up, kind of a Wazim Akram more than a Frank Tyson. And then there's this little sort of twist or whirl where it's kind of the bowler gathers. And then there's a little whistle at the end as the ball goes flying down the wicket. And that's how I learnt to recognise the chaffinch song. And it's one of the easiest and most fun ways to recognise a bird song that I know.
That's fabulous. I feel we're getting right under the skin of the very British condition almost today. With you. Let's continue with our little experiment and cue up our next ornithological marvel for you. Let's have a listen to the next one. Okay, over to you, Richard.
That one was a blackcap, wasn't it?
Two out of two.
Very good so far.
That was almost robotic in its kind of in its staccato kind of rhythm.
Oh, that was an excellent blackcap, excellent version of the blackcap song. The blackcap is possibly my favourite of all bird songs because it's completely mad. It's this weird rollercoastering, raspberrying, spitting thing, you can hear it being belted out from the foliage in spring and summer. One of the reasons I love the Blackcap song so much is that it sounds nothing like music. One of the things I always had a problem with before I really got to grips with birdsong and learned a bit more about it was that people would talk about it being a song, about it being this lovely melody. When you listen to the birds around you, often it just sounds like a mad noise. And nothing sounds as much like a mad noise as a blackcap song. And yet this is a bird that's called the Nightingale of the North, because we don't get actual nightingales up here in the north, but we do get blackcaps, and it's supposed to have this beautiful lyrical song. Whereas the blackcap song doesn't sound like music, but it is a wonderful noise to listen to. And kind of my thesis, so one of my ideas here, is that birdsong doesn't really have to be beautiful for you to want to listen to it. It can be mad and stupid and wild and still be wonderful. In fact, the blackcap gave my book its title. A Sweet Wild Note was what Gilbert White, one of the first great naturalists, that was his phrase for describing the blackcap song.
Excellent. And then let's just pick up again. We have, of course, the third little instalment of our tittering teaser for you, Richard. So let's play this last one and see if you can get your 100% record through to the end. Now that's a beautiful song, Richard. I'd have a guess myself, but perhaps you should you get the expert's privilege.
Well, that one was a wren, which is another absolutely wonderful song. And one thing that you can't really get across on the recording is just how loud it is relative to the countryside around it. Particularly if you're walking through a woodland in May, maybe, and there's a few wrens on the go declaring their territory and so on. The volume that they can achieve while being absolutely tiny birds, much smaller than a robin, is really remarkable. And they do this all year round. They're just little characterful, wonderful birds. I could just listen to that song all day long.
It's a positively delightful sound. And it's been a positive delight, Richard, to speak with you about it. Your excellent book, A Sweet Wild Note, What We Hear When the Birds Sing, is out now, published by Elliot and Thompson. It's a lovely thing. And Richard, congratulations on the book. And a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you for 2018.
The same to you. Thanks very much for having me on.
Tom, I think it's time for a song. This is another Christmas tradition you might never have known you needed. It's Loretta Lynn with To Heck with Old Santa Claus.
Hear his sleigh bells ring. Country legend Loretta Lynn there, Henry. To heck with old Santa Claus. Lovely stuff. I actually thought initially when you mentioned it was music time, you were going to give me a halting, haunting, falsetto version of A Little Town of Bethlehem, for example.
How disappointed are you that that didn't happen?
I'm pleased, and I must just say I'm sure our listeners too are delighted. You're listening to The Monocle Winter Weekly. All this December, we've been enjoying stories from our Winter Weekly newspaper. This week, we're off to Domžale, near Ljubljana in Slovenia, for some winter sports action.
Monocle's favourite hanger-on, Guy Delaunay, recently went to the Ice Climbing European Cup event there to learn about how its participants are pushing the sport for consideration for the 2022 Winter Olympics.
It's a freezing cold evening in Domžale on the outskirts of Slovenia's capital, Ljubljana, but hundreds of people have gathered, steaming cups of mulled wine in hand, to watch the first ever European Cup ice climbing event here on the side of a parking garage in the centre of the town.
It's the equilibrium, so you have to be in the balance, otherwise you fall.
Thomas Kerr is on the board of the International Climbing and Mountaineering Federation, and he reckons ice climbing would be a perfect fit for the Winter Olympics.
So first of all, the winter sports, Winter Olympics, are not that crowded as the Summer Olympics. That's an advantage for us. The second thing is that we say moving vertically is an old human dream, and we are the only sport who does this. You know, all the rest is downhill or whatever, or flat. We go up. And this movement is a natural moving, so it's corresponding to the Olympic idea. Higher, faster, yeah. So
stronger. Saltier, sportier.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the second thing is you have to convince the local organizing committee. So we have not only to work with the IOC, but we have more to work with, in our case now, with the Chinese National Olympic Committee.
It has to be said, this is a pretty gripping spectacle to watch. At the moment, we've got the teenage competitor, Lucas Goertz, who's just skillfully got over an ice barrel suspended from the climbing wall, and he's now making his way up to the top with just under 3 minutes left on the clock to make it.
Maybe it looks like there's just power, but it's a lot about technique.
Janez Folsiak is Slovenia's top ice climber and European champion, but at this event he's set the route the climbers must take up and across the wall.
Well, rock climbing, you feel the hold. But here you just hold your ice axe and you don't know what did you hook on. And these rock holds are not really good. So you have to be really careful and you have to trust your instinct and your experience that you know that you put well, and then go slowly and put your legs on the right position.
So for an event like this, where you've got an artificial wall, and this is brand new, is this a really good simulation of what it's like climbing on ice?
Usually it's easier on the ice. This is more like mixed climbing. Compared to mountains, it would be like some ice and some rock. And here, because it's too warm and it's hard to make a lot of ice, we do it a bit artificially.
Angelika Reiner is Italy!
The climbers all have the same equipment. Two brutally sharp ice axes and a pair of wickedly spiked shoes called fruit boots, but some can't help standing out. Italy's Angelika Reiner is a three-time world champion and one of the sport's biggest stars. She says getting into the Olympics is vital for ice climbing's development, especially as rock climbing will be part of the Tokyo Games.
Ice climbing is not in the Olympics, and in Italy we have no federation for ice climbing. So there is no way of being a professional athlete only for the competitions.
So getting into the Olympics isn't just a matter of your ego for the sport, it's a matter of actually developing it so that athletes can take it seriously and the competition can increase its quality.
I think so, yes. Yes, it would be. Because then you have... I heard now also for sport climbing, there are a lot of young athletes that are going to be supported by their country because it's the first time that climbing is going to be at the Olympics. So there is quite a lot of funding for them. And for ice climbing, it's quite hard because the level has been becoming higher and higher over the past years. You have to be a professional athlete in your training, but you can't be in your payment.
Angelika's strongest competition at Domžale comes from the Dutch climber Marianne van der Steen. She's now in her 30s, but insists that age is no barrier to success in her chosen sport.
I really, really hope to make it to Beijing. And I believe that my body can still do this within, well, it's almost 5 years, 4 years. And if I can keep on training like I do right now. And also what I see is the sport itself and the facilities and the professionality of the athletes is developing so much that there is this possibility to do it. And in that way, the sport is definitely ready for it as well.
Conversely, if you're good enough, you're old enough. The top two in the men's event at Domžale are Switzerland's 18-year-old Lucas Goertz and the overall winner, 16-year-old French climber Luna Ladevant.
Congratulations, Luna! Well done!
Every little move of ice climbing, little evolution, is a way to go to the Olympics. And this is in good way.
So you and Lucas, you're like taken over. The youth are taken over.
Yeah, kind of, I think so.
You've got an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old in the top two.
Yeah, that's great, I think.
So ice climbing's future seems bright, even if Olympic participation is still up in the air. But if the drama at Domžale is any guide, the sport would be a fine addition to the Winter Games. For Monocle, in Domžale, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Guy Delaunay in Domžale in Slovenia there. You can read more seasonal stories in the Winter Weekly newspaper. It's on discriminating newsstands now, or you can still, I think, get the whole bundle of four. Head to the website for details.
Indeed, but you right now are listening to the Monocle Winter Weekly radio show. Good name.
We'll end with a Christmas Eve tradition on the programme, which might possibly be taking place in Iceland as we speak. It's known as Jólabókaflóð, or the Christmas Book Flood.
It's a yearly event that culminates, in many cases, with Icelanders gifting each other books on Christmas Eve. And joining us to explain more from Reykjavik is Eliza Reed. She's a writer, editor, and the co-founder of the Iceland Writers Retreat. And she also holds the title of being Iceland's First Lady. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Eliza. Thanks so much for joining us. To begin with, maybe we can discuss the role of books in Icelandic culture more broadly, because it is a exceptionally literary nation, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Iceland has a really long and rich literary heritage, which comes back from the times of the sagas, which were written centuries and centuries ago, when there were only a few thousand sort of hardy souls eking a living on this island in the North Atlantic for many centuries. We didn't have the resources to build wonderful buildings or create musical instruments, but we could tell these wonderful stories. And that's passed on through generations. And this sort of love of literature and respect for literature still exists today.
Well, Eliza, just on that point, the figures are quite astonishing, aren't they? You know, away from, for example, Reykjavik's status as a UNESCO City of Literature a few years back, this sort of number of literary creative folk definitely stacks up, doesn't it, vis Iceland and other nations. More books per capita published than anywhere else. 5 titles for every 1,000 people. Now, that is amazing. And is that something to do with, I guess, my limited knowledge of things? Might say, oh, you know, it's quite an, well, it's an island and it's quite insular. And so people looked to their books for bigger connections to the world. Is that a sort of a reductionist way of looking at it?
It does stem back from this rich history, and there's always been an emphasis on literacy in general. So again, centuries and centuries ago, children who were confirmed into the church couldn't be confirmed unless they were literate. So there has been a long emphasis, and not only on storytelling, but on writing down those stories. And if you look to the somewhat more modern era during the Second World War, books were some of the only gifts that were available to give to people at the Christmas season. And so that's another reason why they remain so popular today, is that tradition of giving books as gifts over Christmas sort of started around the time of the Second World War.
Eliza, tell me in a bit more detail about the commercial and cultural dynamics of the Christmas book flood, because it's not unusual for publishers all over the world to time their release schedule to ensure that they optimise their windfall during the Christmas season. What's particular about Iceland's book flood?
Well, I think one of the things is that there is a catalogue published every autumn called the Bókatíðindi, which lists all of the new books that are coming out in Icelandic during the Christmas book flood. It's distributed free to all the households, and it's sort of poured over as eagerly as the IKEA catalog is as well. In conjunction with this, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but it's a large majority of the books that are targeted to the domestic audience, so not to tourists, are released in the period between late September to Christmas time. And all of the promotional events in conjunction with that take place during that time as well. So authors do different readings in different places. Companies maybe would have an author come and read to them. Old age homes, workplaces. And my husband, for instance, was a writer, and he was invited to do a talk at a fish processing plant. He was paid in fresh haddock and drove home with a trunk full of frozen fish. He's also done readings outside of the geothermal swimming pools that we have here. So there's all kinds of different environments. And obviously here in the north, it's very dark at this time of year. There's a lot of lights that come out during Advent and the Christmas season, but it's sort of associated with the season to meet and gather somewhere and have lots of light indoors and hear good stories.
I love the idea of a big old trunk full of full of haddock. I might see if I can get that written into my contract here at Monocle, Eliza, in the new year. I mean, it's interesting, a couple of times you've reflected on this social element. And again, at the risk of sort of underlying some maybe sort of preconceived notions of what Iceland is like. Yeah, you mentioned it's dark and there's a time for coming together and this sort of thing. How much is all of this underscored by the social element? And I know that you also run, we mentioned in our introduction, these writers' retreats, which are about sharing knowledge, coming together, workshopping things. And this idea, I mean, telling stories and the sharing of stories is fundamental to so many societies. But do you think Iceland has a better understanding of its real social power, maybe than some other places?
I don't know that we've thought about it in exactly those terms. I think a lot of it comes through tradition. The Icelandic language, I think, also plays a big part. It's a unique, old, beautiful language. It's beautiful to hear spoken, and everybody is very proud of the language itself. And I think that is also closely tied to the success of all these books, because many of the books are written, you know, originally in Icelandic. They're not just translations from another language. And that's sort of what someone, I think it was David Mitchell, called the sagas or things, Iceland's textual treasure. And that's very important for us.
Eliza, what about the literary tastes of Icelandic people? Do they diverge from that of other nations, or is it something that they share?
Well, I think, you know, at Christmas time, it's often very popular to buy the latest crime fiction novel. That sort of Nordic noir trend is also popular in Iceland. And there are several Icelandic authors who publish a book almost every year or every Christmas season. And they tend to be the top selling books of the year. Another category that perhaps you might not think of as much in other countries, I suppose, are nonfiction biographies. Because again, it's a small country. And so very often, every year there's a number of biographies written of former politicians or former actors or sports people or anybody who's been well known or made a contribution to Icelandic society in some way. And those are often very popular simply because so many people know those individuals personally. And they tend to not be tell-alls or anything unapproved. They're usually books that have been written with the blessing of the individual themselves or his or her family. Those tend to also be quite popular.
Just picking up on that point you made about the popularity of the sort of crime thriller, the Nordic noir, if you like, is there a untapped Icelandic literary tradition that could be the next Nordic noir? Obviously, people from without are always looking for the untapped trends. I don't know what it would be if we have Nordic noir. Is it Icelandic irony or something? What could it be possibly?
I think there's a lot of dry humor as well in Icelandic stories, and there's a lot of family connections and things that comes from writing in the sagas where everybody have to explain the context. Perhaps the country's unique nature as well plays a role because there's so much isolation there, these bleak landscapes that even though Iceland is a very safe country, in the fictional worlds, they can lend themselves to all sorts of dark deeds.
Finally, Eliza, perhaps you can recommend some Icelandic books that people within and without of Iceland might be able to gift this Christmas.
Gosh, there's so many, and I'm always a little bit hesitant to recommend specific books because then I feel like I've left out all other sort of good ones. The main crime fiction writers who people would know in the UK are Arnaldur Indriðason, Yrsa Sigurðardóttir, and Ragnar Jónasson.
Listeners can Google them if they're interested.
Yes. I'm sure everyone can immediately know how to spell those names. And there are innumerable other great authors, a woman called Auður Ava Ólafsdóttir. Sjón is very well known as well. He used to write lyrics as well for Björk songs. Hallgrímur Helgason. There's a former mayor of Reykjavik called Jón Gunnar, who's written some very humorous memoirs that have been translated into English. These are just a few of the ones that are cropping up at the top of my head. There's also historical fiction. There's a woman called Vilborg Davidsdóttir who's written some great historical fiction. So it's certainly worth taking a look. And we should certainly have more books translated into English. That's the hardest market, really, for translation because so much is published already in English. But hopefully we continue to get more and more Icelandic books translated.
Indeed. Well, you make an eloquent case. Let's hope that publishers pay heed to that call for action, a seasonal call to action. Eliza, great to speak with you. That was Eliza Reid there, a writer, editor, co-founder of the Iceland Writers Retreat, telling us more about, and I'm going to try it again, Jóla Bóka Flóð. Eliza, great to speak with you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks. Merry Christmas.
Well, there you have it, Henry. Helter skelter, pell mell. We've dashed towards the finish line. Christmas Day almost upon us. I feel very much like the character Ebenezer Scrooge in A Christmas Carol. I've learned the true meaning of Christmas in your company today.
And what is that meaning, Tom?
No, actually, what I meant was, like Ebenezer Scrooge, I feel I've been tormented by awful Christmas spirits after spending time in your company.
That's all we have time for right now for the Monocle Winter Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, our studio manager was Cassie Galpin, and our researchers were Tasha Kleeman and Tom Melville.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but before we go, Henry, let's hand over to Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who's been thinking about the different ways we all enjoy Christmas around the world.
There aren't many weeks or days in the calendar when an editor can down tools, wake up at a civilized hour, sometime between 10 and 11, and start the day without looking at a story list, script, or flat plan, but this one comes pretty close. After a company Christmas party that saw our far-flung colleagues fly into London for a proper party with all the fixings, candlelit dinner, carols by the piano, and a busy dance floor, a quick dash to Stockholm for a gathering of friends and family, more carols under a very grand tree, and a day of broadcasting and hosting a Christmas market from Zurich, it was time to pack up the car early on Tuesday morning and head to Munich, accompanied by Mom, Mats, and the sounds of Tatsuro Yamashita. You might have noticed that Christmas is an important date in my diary, and I have my grandparents on both sides to thank for establishing various rituals from a young age. Mom's Estonian roots meant December 24th was an evening filled with Baltic delicacies, a visit from Santa while I was having my afternoon nap, and presents sometime after the kringle was cut. Now that would be Estonian raisin, saffron, and cardamom bread. On my father's side, it was a late afternoon feast on the 25th with turkey and all the trimmings, presents after dinner, and perhaps a late night skate on Ottawa's Rideau Canal. As family members moved elsewhere, cousins grew up, and dear aunties and uncles passed away, so too did the extended family Christmas. When I moved to the far side of the Atlantic in 1989, I attempted to establish my own Christmas traditions that mixed a bit of back home with friends and family scattered across Europe, the high point being a very snowy and traditional Christmas spent with cousins in Vienna. A few years later, there was a complete inversion of the holiday with a series of Christmases spent north of Sydney in Palm Beach. The first year, it was a bit unsettling to attempt a full Estonian spread without knowing the delis, quality of herring, and the behavior of yeast in a tropical setting, but Mom managed to get the hang of it, and with the help of friends Nancy and Warwick, we got into the Aussie groove with relative ease. Nevertheless, there was always a little something missing on Christmas Eve, and a new apartment in the Engadine offered a chance to set down a few roots and fresh traditions, and it's been part of the Christmas story for coming on 20 years. Recently, there have been a few additions to the mix. Somehow, Munich has inserted itself in the Christmas story, and what a welcome player it is in the Weihnacht cast of must-dos. A new base in Murano has also added a completely different dimension with a sunny house on the south side of the Alps, a Monocle shop nearby, and a host of friends and associates who possess the very fine habits of always showing up with a case of wine, baskets of jam, slabs of speck, and assorted baked goods. Munich found its way onto the Christmas itinerary about 3 years ago when its airport made the most sense as a family staging post, and a few hours in town were the best tone setter for a few weeks in the mountains of South Tyrol. Lunch at the Dallmayr Seafood Bar, followed by visits to Lodenfrei, Radspieler, and the kind of guys, satisfied appetites and tricky gift lists. A quick trolley dash through Kafer's well-stocked aisles also ensured the house would be well-stocked for visitors and lazy days on the terrace. While Zurich has become something of a new base, Munich still beckoned, and we pretty much repeated the same drill of past seasons. Instead of a night stop at the Bachmeier Weissach Hotel, we pushed on a bit further east and spent the evening at Das Regina in Bad Gastein. The following day, it was a turn back to the south through the tunnels and across the valleys of southern Austria before crossing the border into Italy and the temperature and culinary shift that comes with South Tyrol. This year will be Christmas number 3 spent in Murano with its curious microclimate that often consists of cool mornings, big sunny skies, the clearest evenings, and no snow in the town proper. Through rustling palms, days can start wrapped up on the terrace with the coffee and the papers and carry on with layers being removed as the sun crosses towards the Swiss border. Does it ever snow here? Asked our editor Andrew Tuck when he paid a visit shortly after New Year's. Not really, it's usually quite dry in town, but if you drive up to about 600 or 700 meters, you'll start to get snow, I explained. As is often the case with such proclamations, it's perhaps not surprising that the following morning saw the garden covered in white with snow continuing to drift down the whole day. So much for my take on Murano's weather peculiarities, but I'm convinced that it's the region's special climate mixed with its Tiroler and slightly grander architecture that makes it a rather unique place to spend Christmas. A heavy overlay of German Catholicism, dumplings aplenty, and some of Italy's best vineyards 50 minutes away also help. With one official duty remaining for 2017, it will soon be time to decorate the tree, fluff the beds for guests, and run through the menus to be prepared from the 24th through to New Year's Eve. And when all of that's out of the way, I will walk out to the garden to pay a visit to one of our yuzu trees and pick the juiciest, most fragrant fruit from a prickly branch. Upstairs in the bar, the yuzu will be sliced and placed in the bottom of a glass. A chunk of ice will be added, followed by a heavy splash of elephant gin and a trickle of tonic. Cheers, and Merry Christmas.